She said, you're going to fight for your wife, right? You're going to fight for her. You're going to fight for your marriage. And that was a really shocking moment. I was like, oh, I never thought of that. Like, of course I wanted to stay married, but I assumed there was no saving it at all. The direct message would say something like, I just found out my husband is leaving me. I just finished your book. Here's my phone number. Can you call me? You've probably been forgiven by a lot of people. And here you are bragging about how you're somehow so, like, you're so tough that you would never forgive that. I'm like, that's nothing to brag about, man.
I'm excited to welcome a very special guest today. Award-winning author, professor, husband, father, drummer, and one of the funniest and most insightful voices on the page, Harrison Scott Key. Welcome to the Carti Hopecast, where we explore stories that shape us, journeys of resilience, hope, and perseverance. We seek the lessons that emerge when we face the unexpected and find strength in the struggle. You mentioned your vulnerability in writing it, and just to highlight a small picture of how vulnerable you became, in one section of the book, you provide an extensive list of your faults. I think you end up going from A to Z. And you said at one point, nobody told me fighting for my marriage would be less a fight than the kneeling in humiliation at the feet of my enemy. Very strong statement. What did you mean by that, or what were you trying to get across?
Well, we use this language, you know, like, I mean, there's a pivotal moment in the book where a close friend, where I'm sort of assuming that I'm about to get a divorce. I mean, when you find out your spouse, not only has your spouse had an affair, they don't feel bad about it. They're excited about their affair and they want to get married to this other person and divorce you. When you find that out, you're not really thinking about reconciliation. You're like, holy crap. Like, I guess we're done. Like, cause a marriage, you know, it takes two to tango. And if there's one person that doesn't want to tango, then you can't tango by yourself. And so I was just standing on the dance floor thinking, oh, I guess I'm about to get divorced. That's cool, I guess. I don't know. I was not expecting that on a Monday in October, which is when I found out. And when this friend called me and she said, you know, and you probably remember this if you read the book, she said, you're going to fight for your wife, right? You're going to fight for her. You're going to fight for your marriage. And that was a really shocking moment. I was like, oh, I never thought of that. Like, of course I wanted to stay married, but I assumed there was no saving it at all. So we use that verb, fight. You're going to fight for your marriage, or not fight for your wife. Like, I'm a knight in shining armor and she's been kidnapped by a dragon. Although it felt like that on some occasions, it was more like, how are you going to fight for the idea of your marriage? How are you going to fight for your family? Keeping in, you know, like, and even if you, sometimes you have to fight for your family, even if you're getting divorced, right? You fight for what's best for your family, what's best for all of you. And so as a man, when you hear that verb fight, it feels quite literal. Okay. I have a baseball bat in my house. Maybe I'm going to use that to fight for my marriage. Maybe I'm going to use one of these guns or knives or my fists. And I approached, like, when I realized that my wife really hadn't made up her mind yet about what she wanted. And I kind of had a chance to do something, to save something. And what does that mean? Does that mean I go, like, whip this guy's butt or scare him or, I don't know, knife his tires or challenge him to a duel? I mean, what am I supposed to do? Like, it was the strangest experience. And it wasn't until I realized that, you know, like, what is the, you know, I'm not a Greek scholar or Aramaic, but, you know, in the Beatitudes, when Jesus says, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth. And this idea of, we use the word meek to mean like shy, like your head is bowed and you're shy and maybe your eyes are looking down. And I've heard more than one scholar say that, you know, in the sense that it's used in the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, the word meek is more of somebody who has a weapon and keeps it sheathed. Somebody, it's like a metaphor for turning the other cheek. So it's like the meek shall inherit the earth. Those with power who choose not to destroy with it inherit the earth. That's what it's saying.
Power under control.
Yes. And to me, I was like, oh, fighting for my marriage actually may be putting my weapon down. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so amazing about the gospel. And I struggle a lot with faith, and I'm very honest about that in the book. I struggle with God and with a sort of occasional atheism that I have. But what's so interesting about the Bible and about the story of the New Testament is just how much power there is in restraining your power when you are attacked. And so that was a big turning point for me in our story, the kneeling at the feet of my enemy rather than attacking my enemy.
Yeah. Many of our guests on the HopeCast have had their lives turned upside down by illness, grief, or extreme change, as I mentioned earlier. Your books, and especially How to Stay Married, speak to that breakdown. What have readers shared with you about how your story perhaps helped them navigate their own story of loss?
Oh, man, I get all, like, that was probably the most shocking thing of this book coming out, was how many messages I started getting from strangers. In Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, email. I mean, you know, when you write books, it happens. People reach out to you, you know, and they say, like, with my first book, I'd get emails that said, oh, you know, I lost my father a few years too, and your book really helped me grieve his loss. Like, great. Sorry to hear it, man. Great that it helped. Or when people read my second book, you know, which is all about sort of the American dream, and they'd be like, oh, you know, my husband desperately wants to be a writer, and I read your story and realized he needs a copy of this book. Will you sign a copy and mail it to me? You know, like, oh, that's great that you were touched by it. So I was used to the idea, you know, I was used to getting emails and messages about my work, but nothing like this, man. I'm talking about people who had read the book, and the direct message would say something like, I just found out my husband is leaving me. I just finished your book. Here's my phone number. Can you call me? Like, just that direct. Yeah. People who were so desperate for help, or they would say, can we Zoom sometime and talk, or can I call you, or can you give me some advice? People have asked me to speak to their spouse on their behalf. And this, again, this is 2.5 years since the book came out, and I get at least one of these messages almost every day from somebody.
Really?
So it's all over the map. So to answer your question, it's just been all over the map. I would say I don't think I've gotten a single negative message from people like, how dare you write this book? It's all been positive. But it's been pretty heavy to read this stuff. I'm not a therapist. I mean, I'm a comedian, man. Like, why are you telling me this? But I did have to formulate. I realized that, for better or worse, I wrote this book and put it out there, that I have a responsibility to at least, if it's reasonable, to help people. To do something. I'm not their best friend, and I can't pretend to be their best friend. But I did come up with some sort of what I would call useful, like, everyday advice that I gave strangers when they would reach out to me. And the first thing I would usually say is, are you talking to someone you know about this? Like, you need to be talking to somebody you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I've told people, you need a friend. So many people, dude, people don't have friends today, or they have very shallow relationships with friends. Like, you need a good friend who you can tell this to. You also need to probably be talking to a therapist. You know, I'd say, you know, in the South, you know, people are still a little weirded out by therapy, a lot less so than they used to be. Yeah. But, you know, it's sort of like dentistry. You know, people in the South used to be freaked out by dentists too, but we go to them now as well. So maybe we can go to a therapist, because it's about the same kind of thing.
Right. Chloroform.
Yeah. So I say, you need to talk to a friend. You need to talk to a therapist. You probably need to talk to your spouse. And because if y'all have kids, you're going to be in each other's lives for the rest of your lives. So no matter what happens, you need to keep that pathway open to your spouse and not try to, like, I don't know, murder them, hurt them, shut them out. If you have a higher power, you should probably be talking to that. And if you have a mirror, you should probably be talking to that. You should be doing a lot of self-reflection. You know, the best advice I got in all this was, when someone is cheated on, the only way the marriage survives is if the person who was cheated on acknowledges sometimes they suck too. That sometimes they make their marriage a place not really fun to be in. And the person who was cheated on, they're not to blame for the affair. Of course not. But you are in the marriage. And this person, something was going on in that marriage that made them want to leave. Now, it could be their own personal trauma from childhood. It could be whatever. But you're in that and you have to acknowledge, like, okay, maybe I'm not a perfect spouse. When your spouse has an affair, it's very easy to think you are a perfect spouse because you've never done that. And so when people DM me, I try to give them some version of what I just told you about. You need to talk to people. If you don't talk to people, things are going to get really bad for you very quickly. If you try to hold it in or try to solve this on your own, things will get very bad and you're going to mess things up worse than they already are. So, but sometimes people are also really funny when they message me. I get messages. I've gotten messages from like government officials in foreign countries who have had experienced infidelity in their marriage as the person who had, you know, betrayed or who was the betrayer and or the opposite. People from all walks of life, people who are religious, people who aren't, people who said like, I've never been married, but I'm in a long-term relationship. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in marriage, but I read your book and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just been the wildest experience of getting to know people.
It's a pretty universal issue, I imagine. And you know, what you explore is just story of redemption really is something that seems like it would just appeal to everyone.
Betrayal is a heavy word, but that's something that I've learned in this experience is that regardless of ideology, worldview, philosophy, religion, that there is no culture in the world that thinks lying is okay. There is no culture in the world that thinks betrayal is good. You know, in Dante's Inferno, the lowest level of hell is for the traitors. For the betrayers, not for the cheats, you know, not even for the liars, not even for the war criminals. It's for the people who betrayed their people, their cause, their nation, their marriage. And that's been an interesting insight. Like, oh, wow, we all like to think we're all so different. And, it, you know, red versus blue or left versus right or freedom versus something else. I don't know. But like at the end of the day, natural law is pretty consistent across cultures. People pretty much all believe that we should all tell the truth. We should all keep our promises. But you know what? What is also true is that not every worldview believes in forgiveness. And I've met a lot of people who do not believe in forgiveness. And those people tend to be really sad and angry people. So if you're sad and angry and you don't believe in forgiveness, I mean, some people take it as a badge of honor to say they would never forgive that. They could never forgive that. People have said that to me when they find out what happened in the book. They always say like, oh, I could never forgive that if my spouse did that. And I'm like, well, that's real sad for you, man, because you've probably screwed a few people over yourself. And you've probably been forgiven by a lot of people. And here you are bragging about how you're somehow so like, you're so tough that you would never forgive that. I'm like, that's nothing to brag about, man.
I would imagine that continues to make you really approachable. You've walked it.
Yeah.
So one of your quotes, you need many virtues to stay married, including the most obvious and impossible of virtues, you need comedy. How has humor helped you not just endure the hardest parts of your life, but actually reflect on them and process them along the way?
Humor is a little bit like that little shoebox you make so you can see a lunar eclipse or a solar eclipse. You know, you can't look, sometimes you can't look directly at the pain, but you can build a little shadow box camera with your shoebox there and you can, you know, humor lets you look at something that's too painful to look directly at. It lets you acknowledge, you know, what's so weird and cool about humor is that, and often when you're writing it, or if you're a naturally funny person, like people who are naturally funny are not thinking about comedy theory. They're just being themselves because of how they were raised and whatever childhood trauma they experienced. I mean, everybody experienced childhood trauma. If you don't think you did, you definitely need therapy because you did too. Because just being alive is often quite traumatic in the sense of not knowing why this is happening or that's happening or, you know, seeing something terrible when you were young. So people aren't thinking about comedy theory when they're being funny. But what's so cool about it is that if I can make you laugh, that means I have said something that you also agree with and understand without ever saying the thing or ever asking you if you agree with me or not on it. If I can make you laugh, it's an instant connection. We are both people and we have something in common in this life. If I can make you laugh or you can make me laugh. I mean, what's the one thing you say when you see a great comedian making jokes? I mean, the one thing I say, like, and I've always been like this, I'm laughing and I turn to my wife or my mom or whoever's with me and I'm like, that's so true. Oh my gosh, that's so true. It's like you're so surprised that somebody else thinks this secret thing that you thought only you thought. Mm-hmm. And So what's cool about comedy is it admits of this third thing. And it lets you look and talk about stuff kind of obliquely. And I realized, so I've been telling stories about my dad all my life. Like when I was a kid, when I was in elementary school, high school, college, I was always telling funny stories about my dad and all the sort of chaos that we got up to, hunting, fishing, and, you know, football and baseball and all that stuff. And it wasn't until I started writing the book, you know, when I was basically in my 30s, that I was like, oh, I was always funny about him because I had questions and confusions about our relationship and why he would make me do some of this stuff or ask me to do this or why he seemed so disappointed in me. Oh, that's why I'm making a joke. I'm making a joke because there's some pain there. And you know what? When you're, you know, I don't know, at a party, it's a lot easier to make a joke about your weird, you know, football coaching dad than it is to say, I had a strained relationship with my father and I'm not sure I'm quite over it. And I have issues with authority because of him. You can't say that at a party. If you do, you know, like you're a loser. Yeah, you don't talk like that.
Conversation killer. Yeah.
But you can say, oh, let me tell you this story about this time my dad asked me to help him cheat in a football game so he could win the national championship or the, you know, yeah, regional championship. Like, so
it's a story.
It's like, you know, it's Mary Poppins. It's a little sugar to help the medicine go down. And as long as it's not all sugar, there's a little medicine in the sugar, then people tend to react to that. They appreciate that you went there and went to that place. So comedy is weird. I struggle with this current book I'm writing. I have whole sections that aren't funny at all. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, do I like that?
Yeah. Is it, how are people going to receive this?
I know my agent's going to hate it. And I'm like, so part of it is like, well, it's nice to, you know, if you're a funny person, any funny person listening, you get so like, whenever you're not funny, everybody in the world is like, are you okay, dude? Is everything okay? And it's a lot of work being funny. And you realize like, oh, yeah. Actually, I'm fine. I'm just kind of chilling today. So give me a break. And so I've been playing around with my writing too and wondering like, is it okay if it's not funny? Is that not me? Are there so many kinds of comedy? There's a kind of silly hyperbole where you're obviously being ironic and not being serious. And then there's these funny descriptions that you can make that are obviously hyperbolic and not literal. I'm playing around with all that, but it's a challenge. I mean, people don't want just a funny book. They'll get tired of it quick and they'll close it after a couple of chapters. It's just like eating cupcakes for dessert. It's a cool idea, but about three cupcakes in, it's not filling. It doesn't feel like a meal. And so for anybody out there who wants to write a book, and is a funny person, you got to put a little seriousness in there to make it, you know, good.
Well, speaking of your style of storytelling, you managed to make space for both the sacred and absurd often in the same sentence. How did this style of storytelling come to you? Because it it does show up certainly in The World's Largest Man, and congratulations, Who Are You Again? It's, you know, you took a little bit of a different path. You know, you can see, and I've actually read your books a couple of times now because I enjoyed them so much. But how did you come up with kind of that cadence?
I don't know, man, a lot of trial and error, you know, part of learning how to write these books was, how do I put on page the way I think I am when I'm talking to people? Mm-hmm. You know, what they say is like, you know, you want to read aloud anything you write, read it aloud, see how it sounds. You know, you probably have to read from scripts when you're recording your podcast, right? You have to read little paragraphs and stuff. And you write a paragraph and you're like, yeah, that looks pretty good. But then when you read it on air, you're like, I sounded like C-3PO. I can't do that. You know, you got to make it feel like yourself. And part of writing is just, part of finding your voice as a writer is trying to find a way to express in literary symbols on a page the way that you are with real people in the real world. And the closer you can get that, then when people read it, they're like, oh my gosh, this sounds just like Adam. I can just hear Adam saying this. To me, the biggest compliment I get is when somebody reads something of mine and they're like, I could hear you saying that. That is the highest compliment. So one answer to that question is the, you know, the sort of sacred and the profane all together is also just kind of a way that I talk. Comedy is all about surprise, and shock, not all about it, but that's a huge part of it. Punchlines are a surprise. Certain word choices are surprising. So I don't know, man, I think there's some joy in surprising people and shocking people. I think when you write humor, it's very easy to look at it as just kind of not just a very unserious literary endeavor. So when you can make a joke like that, that shows you understand the complexities of theology and yet can somehow reduce them to this kind of comic absurdity, mm-hmm. You can earn people's respect a little bit more and make them feel like, okay, this book maybe is worth reading. So it's a bit like doing a magic trick or... You know, it's like, I don't know. It's just, I think it makes the reading process more enjoyable when it veers so wildly from, I'm going to make you laugh about this thing, but I'm like going to make you cry right here. It's thrilling to me as a writer and a reader to experience that.
Well, after listening to you read The World's Largest Man, and yeah, a few of the chapters I've honestly listened to a few times. I told my dad, I said, you've got to listen to Harrison Scott Key's delivery. And he later reported to me that he found himself laughing out loud on an elliptical machine in the morning at the gym, listening to your book. And I tell you this because your delivery and your vulnerability has made you profoundly relatable, it seems, to others, and obviously by your own stories and the emails you continue to get, and amidst their own really ridiculous circumstances. In your daily pedestrian experience with family, work, and life in general, are you still finding yourself taking notes, just saying, hey, that could work, you know, that could work? And I'm not meaning to get you to reveal too much about your latest book, but just wondering how that's working for you right now.
Yeah, that's very much, I mean, that's just sort of how I've always been. I mean, I used to, you know, have a little journal and I would keep everything there, but just any given day, any given moment. I mean, I have I've got about four books right now that I'm kind of slowly working on. There's one main one that I'm doing, but I've got three others that are kind of very real and I have a lot of thoughts and notes on them. And something's always happening to me that feels like, oh, that totally needs to be in this book. I mean, the most frustrating thing is that funny stuff happens to me every day. And I just can't, I don't have time to record it all. And it makes me so mad. Like, there was this moment that happened, where I won't tell the whole story because I'm sure it's kind of boring. I haven't written it yet, so I don't know how to quite make it funny, but I was eating dinner with my family and you know, I live with four women. I have four wives. I have my wife and then three daughters, and they're all kind of like my bosses. And they're so amazing and beautiful and sweet, but they are so mean, man. They can be so mean to me. They are just brutal. I mean, they're funnier than I am. So they're just brutal. And they were basically making fun of me while I was like the way I was eating. And we were watching Jeopardy, and I was like guessing, you know, I was guessing the answers, and I was like really into it. I love Jeopardy, and I would like eating, and I was turning them, and I would like guess, and they were just making fun of me. And I got so butthurt. I was like, yeah, I bought this house. I bought all this food. I bought this TV. Like, just give me a moment to just enjoy it. You know, like, oh, I was so mad. And I was like, if I hear another word out of any of y'all, I'm leaving. And my wife was like, nah, nah, nah. And I was like, all right. I was like, I'm out. I took my food. And they're like, where are you going? I was like, I'm going to go in my office, and I'm going to go watch Jeopardy on my laptop because I want to have some peace. And then, of course, they all follow me into my office. And they're like, oh, you big baby. And then they were like, please come back and eat with us. Like, we were just picking. And it was this hilarious moment of like them being mean to me and how butthurt I got about it. And I remember thinking, I wish somebody had been recording that, because I could use that in something. I don't know what, but I could use that. But I was just too tired, because I mean, like, I would spend my whole life just typing up notes about what just happened.
Oh, yeah.
And so I do have a couple of notes on my phone of just things that I see or hear that are funny. Now, I guarantee you these are not actually funny, but I'm going to see if I can. These are all so bad. You didn't ask me to do this, but.
No, this is great. This is perfect.
All right. Hold on. Some of these are so crass. I can't read. I don't know. Like, if you want to know what hell feels like, just come hear my preacher. Like that, I wrote that in a sermon. I mean, it's not that funny. It sounds like Jerry Clower, maybe.
Did you write that in the moment?
Reading the room at a fifth grade level. That's pretty funny. That's good. But so some of these, is Todd short for toddler? Like, that's not really funny, but kind of like that makes me laugh a little bit. But I have a whole thing of just, and part of it is, and I always tell students this, you may never go back and use that stuff, but it gets you good at observing the world and sort of taking it in and being able to catch like so much beauty and art and poetry are just flying by all of us all the time. And taking notes like that attunes you more to how to catch a really interesting thought and put it in your pocket. Maybe, and even if you don't use that thought later, the act of catching it and writing it down will make you better at doing that later when other ideas come that you will use. And so it's just a good habit to be sort of recording your own thought, thinking about your own thoughts.
Well, Harrison, this conversation has been a gift. We really appreciate you being so open, so human, so funny and printing in person. I'd love to be able to hear anything else you wanted to say, and also just what's the best place for people to be able to find your book, follow your work.
I do a lot of sharing of memes on the internet, on Instagram. I think I think my handle is Harrison Scott Key, all one word, on Instagram. Yeah. On X, it's just Harrison Key, all one word. I do a little bit on X/Twitter, but not much. I don't talk to many people on it. Every now and then I'll tweet something. They're the dumbest tweets. These are not funny tweets. If I could compare my tweeting to anybody, it'd probably be somebody like Larry King. Like, it's the most boring old man. Like, I love soup. You know, it's just something like that, which to me, that's funny, but, I don't get any likes on anything I do on Twitter. I do most of my stuff on Instagram, and I connect with fans and readers mostly through Instagram. I do have a website, which is just my full name, harrisonscottkey.com. And my assistant checks it. I get messages and invitations to speak or to appear at events and stuff through my website usually, and my assistant gives all those to me. But yeah, it's mostly Instagram where you can find me. I am on Facebook too, but I really hate it, and I'm trying to quit and retire as quickly as possible from Facebook, but I can't seem to pull myself out of it completely. But yeah, I'm working on this new project. I think it's going to... Here's what I'll say. I won't say much about it. It is also a nonfiction book. So it will be my fourth nonfiction book. It is autobiographical, and it deals with a topic that I have not dealt with in all three of my previous books, but only as a sort of tangential topic. And in this book, it's sort of the main focus. My wife is in it. She was very sad when I told her I was working on a new book. She was like, I'm not in this one. Am I? Please tell me I'm not in this book. I'm like, she is, but she's a slightly more minor character, I think, in a way, in this book. But she doesn't realize, but she's going to have to write something for this book too, but she doesn't know that yet. So please don't tell her, cause I'll tell her later. My mom's in this book, my daughters, a lot of my friends, a lot of people that I've never met. So if you like my work and you like the characters you've met, then you'll like this new book too. But I think it'll probably be 2027 before it's out, and I don't have a title for it yet.
Okay. We can't wait to read it.
I can't either.
Well, Harrison Scott Keith, thank you so much for being on the Hopecast today.
Thanks, Adam. This is cool. Also, it's just fun to be interviewed by somebody who has a very familiar accent. And it's good. You got a good way of talking. I like it. And it's nice.
It comes through, yeah.
I don't get interviewed by a lot of people from the South, and it's nice.
Really?
So yeah. I mean, you know, everybody's got that standard American accent these days anyway. The older I get, the more my Mississippi has come back into my way of talking. I think when I was a young professional, I tried to clean it out of my way of talking.
Yeah.
But I still sound like I'm from Mississippi to people that, you know, that I just meet. I used to take that as a insult, but now I take it as a compliment.
Well, it's been great. I feel like we've just been hanging out here, and I appreciate your transparency. It's been fun to talk to you.
Yeah, man. Well, thanks for the invitation.